Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I recently read a beautiful obituary for an old friend's brother. It mentioned his service in the Air Force in Vietnam and his later career, but the part that stuck with me was this sentence. He was a teacher of bike riding, chess, tennis, tire changing, debate, fishing, piano playing, computers, swimming and diving, macaroni and cheese cooking, BB gun shooting, singing, tobogganing, music appreciation, ABCs, photography, driving, and joke telling. Does that not tell you everything you could want to know about this man? Most of us have been encouraged since childhood to think very deliberately about the things that might someday go on our resumes, but it's unlikely anybody will pass out copies of our CVs at our funeral. There, we will be remembered not for what we were, but for who we were and how we touched the lives of the people around us. My guest has become convinced the world would be a better place if we all devoted more time and energy to building what he calls eulogy virtues. David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times and a commentator for NPR and the PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Road to Character, and he will be in town next Monday, May 11th, for events sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, welcome back to Think.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
So a few years ago, you heard this vintage radio program originally broadcast just after VJ Day at the end of World War II. And where we might have really gloated, you were astonished by the humility people showed.
Yes, all epiphanies started on NPR. I was listening to in my market here on WMU in Washington. They rebroadcast all radio shows on Sunday evenings. And I happened to hear a show that was called Command Performance that would broadcast live on VJ Day in 1945. Just hours after the Japanese announced their surrender. And Bing Crosby is the host who gets out there and he says, we've just learned we've won this war, but I guess we don't feel too proud. We're just humbled and we're glad we got through it. And Burgess Meredith, the character actor, gets out there and says, he reads a passage from Ernie Pyle, who says that we won the war because we have brave soldiers and a lot of material abundance, but we didn't win it because we're better than anybody else. We should just try to stay modest and be worthy of the peace. And I was struck by the beautiful tone of humility in that at what could have been, as you say, a moment of great gloating. Then I go inside, watch a football game, and a quarterback throws a pass to a wide receiver who gets tackled after a two-yard gain, and the defensive player does what all professional athletes do after moments of supreme personal achievement. He does a victory dance in honor of himself. And it occurred to me I'd heard a bigger self-puffing victory dance after a two-yard gain than after winning World War II. And so that sort of symbolized to me a shift in culture from a culture of self-effacement, which says I'm no better than anybody else, but nobody's better than me, to a culture of achievement, which says, look at me, look what I've done, I'm pretty distinct.
After World War II ended, it's not surprising maybe that we wanted to enjoy prosperity for a while, but how do you think we all ended up feeling like we had earned the right to reside at the center of our own universes?
Yeah, I think people, first they wanted to consume. You know, they'd had the Depression, they had the war, and they wanted to consume. And so they wanted to just say, you know, my desires, whatever I want to spend on, that's good. I'm going to go with my desires. I trust my inner side. And then they'd seen the horrors of the war, and they sort of wanted to turn the page. And there were a whole series of books that came out right after the war, writing a new Ten Commandments. And it was the new commandments were like, thou shalt love thyself, thou shalt accept thyself. And so the self-esteem movement was really born in the late 40s, really. There was a thing called humanistic psychology by Carl Rogers. And it was, you know, just love yourself. You're wonderful inside. Just love yourself. And I would say for the last, you know, we would never want to go back to the era of the 1940s. It was a more racist, sexist culture. The food was really boring. but in some ways, I think they had a little more modesty than we do. And that modesty, that humility is really at the basis of building character. If you don't have humility, which is accurate self-awareness, then you have nothing.
At the heart of this book are two paths we can take to pursue success, personified by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik as Adam 1 and Adam 2. How are they different?
Yeah, Adam 1 is sort of the external side of us, and it's a legitimate side, but it's only half of us. It's the side that wants to have a great career, have some status, make some money, start a company, whatever you want to do. It's external success, and Soloveitchik celebrates that. But he says there's another side of our nature, which is internal. It's not only wanting to do good, but to be good, to have the sort of virtues which they will say at your funeral, whether you're honorable, brave, courageous, whether you're capable of deep love. And Soloveitchik says these two sides of our nature are in both of us. And I happen to think we live in a culture that puts a lot of emphasis on Adam 1, on the resume side of our nature, and forgets Adam 2. And a lot of us are more clear about how to build a career than how to build good character. I saw a study the other day from the Harvard School of Education where they asked 10,000 junior high school students, what do your parents care more about, whether you get good grades or whether you are kind? And 80% of them said, my parents care much more about me getting good grades. And, you know, I'm a parent, and I confess sometimes I've nagged my kids more about tests than about kindness. And so it's not a wonder that they get that message.
Well, it's interesting because not only does our society seem to prefer Adam 1, but often we look at people who, you know, would support Adam 2 as like suckers of some kind. Like they're going to get run over by the way society is now.
Yeah. And in the book, the way I think, you know, I wrote the book because I wanted to learn how to have a good inner life, how to have character, how to have, you know, occasionally once a month or so, you meet somebody who just radiates an inner light. They seem joyous and happy and patient, and they treat you well. And if you're in trauma, they show up for you. And I wanted to be a little more like those people. You know, the people in the book are people I studied to try to learn how to do that. They all were people who at age 20 were kind of pathetic, but by age 70, they were kind of amazing. People like Frances Perkins and Dorothy Day and General Eisenhower. And, you know, they had great careers, but they also had really profound and virtuous inner lives. So I don't think they were suckers because they could do both. And I do think it's possible to do both and balance your life properly.
Eisenhower had to learn to get his emotions in check.
Yeah, you know, we've all got a core sin, if you want to put it that way. And for some people, it's egotism. For some, it's vanity. Some people are emotionally needy. For Eisenhower, it was temper. When he was 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating, and his mom wouldn't let him. And he threw a temper tantrum, and he punched a tree in his front yard, and he rubbed all the skin off his knuckles. And she sent him to his room, and she read him recited a verse from Proverbs, which is, he that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city. And when Eisenhower wrote his memoirs like 60 years later, he said that was the most important conversation of his life because, A, it taught him humility, that he had a problem, and, 2, it taught him that the core of his life was beating that problem. Not, you know, the external climb of success was important, but the internal confrontation with your own weakness is how you build character.
It's funny when you mention a word like sin, which even in my very Catholic 1970s childhood was something we were encouraged to recognize in ourselves and to feel guilty about. It's been reframed so that it's applied without irony or sarcasm to our decisions to, like, drink Frappuccinos, right? And self-discipline is viewed as this means to an end, like saving enough for retirement. How did this happen?
Yeah, you know, we got rid of the word sin. We got rid of a lot of words. And, you know, I think a lot of people, and certainly the college students I teach, they're not bad people at all. They're wonderful people, but they have no moral vocabulary. A lot of words that earlier generations had to talk about the drama that was going on inside their own souls. We don't have the words, or we don't use the words, or the words have lost their power. And it's very hard to be aware of that moral drama if you don't have words. And those words are things like sin, soul, redemption, grace. And the word sin went away in part because people, self-righteous and smug people, misused it. They used it to punish pleasure. They used it to punish sex. And they used it to make people really feel depraved and horrible about themselves. So I sort of understand why it went away. But I think it's worth reviving. It's worth reviving because it is true that we all are broken in some way. We all have some weakness. And it's built into our nature. I think that's just an elemental fact. Second, it reminds us that life is a moral adventure. A word like weakness or limitation doesn't quite carry the same moral weight as the word sin. And I think it's worth reminding that when you make decisions, you're building yourself into either something better or something worse, something more moral or something less moral. And finally, I like the word sin because it's collective. We each have individual weaknesses, but we all have the same sins. And we all sin together, and we all combat sin and try to support each other to be better together. So it reminds us that we're in a community.
Lots of people are quick to assess what is and is not morally acceptable. Talk about the distinction between morals and virtues.
Yeah, well, I guess I would say the virtues are things that that are about commitments. One of the things I've learned that we all have a tendency to just mess things up, but none of us are wise enough to defeat our own self-deceptions. None of us are strong enough to defeat temptation all the time. And so What we rely on is redemptive assistance from outside. And when I started this book, I thought that character, I had this Victorian notion of character, that it was a little Victorian iron guy in the middle of you. And it was he was saying, like, no, 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 you know, don't resist temptation, don't eat that dessert, don't tell that lie. But none of us have that guy. He's not strong enough. But the people who are in the book who behave beautifully are people who are able to make amazing commitments, really strong commitments to things outside themselves, to a cause, to a philosophy, a great love for another human being. And so I read in the book that a person with character in the realm of the intellect, she has fundamental convictions about profound things. In the realm of emotion, she's enmeshed in a web of unconditional love. And in the realm of action, she's committed to causes that can't be completed in a single lifetime. And so people with character are just firmly anchored in the world and are able to commit. We emphasize freedom a lot, but character is really all about finding things to commit to.
Before I read this book, I would have thought Frances Perkins belonged in the Adam 1 camp, right? Because she, you know, was the first female cabinet secretary. She was very accomplished. But in fact, her personal story had a great deal to do with her commitment to public service.
Yeah, she was sort of scattered a bit in life. She went to the school at Mount Holyoke where they fired her with a moral zeal to do something heroic. But like a lot of people in their 20s, she just couldn't find the right thing. Nothing really grabbed her. You know, we tell our students, follow your passion, follow your passion. But I saw a study of this. 80% of college graduates don't have a passion. They don't know what their passion is. And so she's wandering around trying, you know, she's a very good person, but she's sort of unfocused. And she happens, something happens to her. And so it wasn't what she, it wasn't what do I want from life. It was what life was asking of her. And what happened was in 1913, she was having tea in Washington Square in Lower Manhattan, and she hears a commotion. She rushes outside, and she stumbles on a fire, one of the most famous fires in American history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. And she sees hundreds of people die. And in that moment, she has what I call in the book her call within the call, which is to say she had a calling. She knew she wanted to be an activist. But at that moment, it purifies. Herself is quieted. She'll work with anybody. She'll do away with her gentility. She'll compromise with anything. She spends the next 50 or 60 years ferociously turning herself into an instrument for a cause, the cause of worker rights and worker safety. And she leads from that point forth a very tough and disciplined life, not only succeeding on the outside, but really forming a deep integrity and a constancy of purpose on the inside.
It seems like if we could all get there, it would take away a lot of the noise that distracts us from doing something that really matters.
You know, I do think, you know, we live at a time where it's hard to focus on the character, on the inner life, on this Adam 2 side, in part because, you know, we're busy. We live in a very competitive world, and you got to spend a lot of time on your career. Second, we have, you know, attention span problems, at least I do. You have, you know, we have fast and shallow communications. It's really hard to be quiet and hear the still soft voices in the depths. Finally, we have social media where we all have a tendency to be broadcasting ourselves. And, you know, trying to be little celebrities. And so I think that just makes it hard, and it's important to set time aside. A lot of the people I write about in the book, some of them kept journals so they could really be honest with themselves. Some of them prayed. They all found a way to step outside the culture and form a counterculture.
We're speaking this hour with David Brooks, who is a columnist for The New York Times and a commentator for NPR and the PBS NewsHour. His new book is called The Road to Character. He'll be in town next Monday, May 11th, for events sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to jump in on this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York Times columnist and NPR and PBS NewsHour commentator David Brooks. His new book is called The Road to Character. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. David, do you think that our lack of moral fiber has made us weak as a society?
No, I you know, I'm not a big person believing we're in some sort of moral decline. Cultures have problems and they solve problems. I think we've become over the last few decades a lot fairer. In many ways, we're living in a period of social repair. A lot of social indicators that used to be going south are now heading north. Crime is down. Teenage pregnancy is down. Abortion rates are down. Divorce rates are down. Things are, in general, going okay. But we do have this problem with ego. We have a larger political problem. That's sort of a separate matter. And the problem of ego and the problem of pride is less of a social problem and more of a personal problem. This, you know, a lot of my life is writing about politics and being a political pundit. But this book is not about politics. It's about the inner life. And I think it's important to defend a space and say that there are parts of our lives that really matter are the parts that are about relationships, about the virtues we have, whether you're honest and straightforward, and about how to live well and really be there for people and deserve that great eulogy. And so to say we all have to struggle with that and we all need a language to struggle with that is an eternal problem. It has nothing to do with the larger health of society.
What does humility do to benefit the people that we interact with?
Well, first of all, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, egotism is, I say in the book, is a voracious hunger in a small space. And egotists are always being silly. They're always prideful. They're always touchy. They're sometimes ridiculous. And they're ignoring other people. When you meet a humble person, it just strikes you as it's nice to be around. But the big quality of humility is self-awareness. And it's knowing your strengths, that we're all splendidly endowed, but it's also knowing your weaknesses. And so it's saying, you know, my life, I'm gonna sit home at night and I'm going to think, you know, what's my core weakness? For a friend of mine, his problem is hardness of heart, he says. He's very busy. People are always asking him of stuff. And he's not always there for them. He's thinking about the next appointment. Or he's at a meeting and he's thinking about the smart thing he can say rather than really listening to what the other people are saying. And so he sits at home at night and he thinks, you know, how did I do today? Did I do okay? Did I do better? And he spends each day trying to be a little better. And so for him, it's sort of an adventure. Some days are wins, some days are losses. And humility is the first step on that process.
Is it easier for you to be humble or recognize the importance of it now that you are, you're not a little celebrity. In certain circles, you are a big star. And you can walk into a room knowing that people recognize who you are. Therefore, you don't have to sort of fight to make yourself known.
Yeah, I guess if I looked around at if I looked around at the world of celebrities and I thought, look at all those very famous people, they're really striking for their humility. Then I would think there's a connection between celebrity and humility. But I see the opposite link. I see celebrities being extremely pompous jerks a lot of the time. And I think, you know, I spend a lot of my time in front of microphones. The one sentence in the book that I think my friends agree with the most is I say I'm paid to be a narcissistic blowhard. And I am. I write a newspaper column. I'm on NPR. I'm on PBS. I'm paid to volley my opinions and to send them out there and to appear more certain than I feel, to look smarter than I really am. And so I would say the challenge of my job is, and it's a challenge for a lot of us who are out there trying to promote something or sell something, there's a tendency toward smugness, and there's a tendency toward narcissism. And I think every job comes with some temptation. If you're in sales, maybe you get used to spinning too much. If you're in politics, you're the product you're selling, so it is a tendency to hollow out yourself. Every job has some character challenge, and I would say whatever celebrity I've achieved, it's made me, it's reminded me how much I need to counteract the corrupting influences of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now. We have, looks like, Jason in Dallas. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Brooks, I'm just a little concerned that you're talking about moral character when you promoted the Iraq War, a war based on very dubious justifications that led to hundreds of thousands dead, and you just basically spouted Republican talking points from your masters, and now here you are talking about sin. It's just kind of a little hypocritical. I'll leave you to respond. Thank you.
You know, I guess I address politics a little differently than you. I think politics is a competition between half-truths, and that each side has a piece of the truth, and we're trying to find the right balance. And I guess I observe in my own life that I know a lot of liberals who are wonderful people and a lot who are schmucks. I know a lot of conservatives who are wonderful people and a lot who are schmucks. And I don't think there's a monopoly on virtue on one side or the other. And so I do think that's a difference between you and me.
What is the – in our society, I've thought a lot about this. There seems to be a lack of empathy today, and maybe that has always existed. We just have a lot more tools to sort of show how little empathy we have for other people. But I don't know if you're familiar with John Ronson's most recent book, but he wrote about the internet shaming culture. And it's stunning how easy we find it to be outraged by other people's behavior. And you know, it's harder to imagine that we could do anything that would leave us similarly vulnerable to criticism.
Yeah, I do think the rise in narcissism has contributed to the polarization. If you realize that you could be wrong and you realize your behavior has shortcomings, then you know you need the people who disagree with you to counterbalance your own possibility you're wrong or your own weaknesses. But if you think you have 100% of the truth or you have the truth by the short hairs, then the people who disagree with you are just in the way. And if they're just in the way, then destroying them is the logical next step. And so I have, you know, one of the figures in the book is Dwight Eisenhower, as I mentioned. And Eisenhower, at the end of his term, he gave a very beautiful speech, which was his farewell address. And he said, you know, competition, each side has a piece of the truth. And we just got to try to balance. And the people on my side, we have a danger of the military-industrial complex. We have a danger of feeding our own self-interest and creating this industrial complex. And we have to be suspicious of our own, the military's tendency to become bloated and big and greedy. And so that, to me, was the epitome of a modest approach to politics, understanding that your own side has a tendency to become as self-interested as the other side. And I do think the rise of narcissism has eliminated some of that.
What does it take to build our own capacity for candid self-examination?
A lot of things. I think a couple of things. One is suffering. We all go through moments of suffering. None of us should welcome them, but they do come, whether you get fired, you get dumped, you lose a loved one. And Paul Tillich, the theologian, says, in those moments of suffering, take us beneath the everyday aspects of our lives and remind us we're not who we thought we were. Tillich writes that they carve a hole in what we thought was the basement of our soul, and they carve a hole through that floor and reveal a cavity below and reveal a cavity below. And so those moments of suffering can be used to become moments of self-awareness, moments of humility, because when you suffer, you realize you're not in control of yourself and that you can't control your suffering. And you do see deeper into yourself. One of the figures in the book is Samuel Johnson. And Johnson had a really radically wretched early life, as he put it. But he took that suffering into a commitment of self-awareness and then also great empathy. Because he suffered so much, he had tremendous empathy for other people who suffered. The way Franklin Roosevelt, for example, developed empathy for other people after he suffered from polio. And then it lifted him up, you know, suffering. People tend to want to take their moments of suffering and turn into a holy cause. I have friends who lost a child at age 6, and they didn't say, hey, you know, we suffered for a few years in grief, let's go party and have fun now. They created a foundation so that other children would not suffer the way their child had. And so they wanted to turn their suffering into a narrative of growth and service. And so I would say that is one of the things that tends to happen that leads people to their depths.
You mentioned FDR, and he is a fascinating case, someone who was known to be sort of haughty and, you know, difficult to get along with before his illness. We wonder if he would have achieved the levels of greatness that he did if he hadn't been struck with polio.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I think it had a deepening effect. Lincoln, too, he had went through depressions in his 20s, and it had a deepening effect. It should be said of both of those men, for example, though, it wasn't just suffering. It was also a great optimism and a great joy. And one of the other, you know, we wouldn't say somebody had a really deep life if they hadn't tasted some suffering. But likewise, I don't think we'd say someone had a deep life if they weren't capable of really tremendous love. And so one of the characters in the book is Dorothy Day. And she did have her down moments. She was a very disorganized young woman and drank too much and caroused too much and suicide attempts and abortions and things. But she gave birth to a daughter. And that moment of birth changed her life. She said she talked about the joy she felt when they placed her child in her arms. And with that came a need to worship and to adore. And her love for her daughter spilled through her daughter and out into the world. And she formed a radical newspaper, The Catholic Worker. She formed homeless shelters, soup kitchens. And her love just was solidified by that birth. And she spent the next 60 years not only serving the poor, but living within the poor and living a life of poverty so she could be as pure and as good as possible.
What does it take to find a vocation in life when people, you know, may or may not be in a position to earn their living doing the thing that they are passionate about that puts good into the world?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And but they can find a need. As I said, I think it's about, as one novelist put it, where your deep gladness meets the world's deepest need. You know, the one example of vocation I give in the book is a guy named Viktor Frankl, who was a psychologist in the 1930s. He was thrown into a concentration camp, and he said, hey, this wasn't what I was planning for life, but I'm here. I might as well suffer. I might as well study what people are going through in moments of real stress. And he became a psychologist, and that became his mission. And he would tell people who are contemplating suicide, he would tell them, life is not done asking things of you, and you do not have a right to end your life because that you're here to serve something, and life has questions for you which you still have a responsibility to answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phone to Eric in Dallas. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I'm wondering how much of building character is dependent on self-actualization, and what impact does poverty have on getting there?
Yeah. Well, it depends. What do you mean by self-actualization, Eric, if you're still on the line?
Well, building character is kind of the same thing as, you know, like meeting your needs, like in Maslow's hierarchy, and then working on more complex concepts like empathy, blah, blah, blah. If you're starving, you can't really worry about those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought a lot about that question. I think my response would be just observe empirically. I've spent a lot of time covering poverty. I've been in very poor areas of the world for quite a lot as part of my career. And I've never met anybody who said, I'll worry about virtue later. I just, you know, I want to get more money. The churches and synagogues and mosques are filled with people who are poor, but who want to live a life of virtue and want their lives to have meaning, and they want to treat people well around them, and they want to be good. And if they're religious, they want to worship God. And so in my observation, whether you're poor or rich or young or old, you're born with a moral imagination, an instinct to want to have a meaningful life, not just a rich life. And that hunger to have that meaning, that hunger to have purpose, the hunger to be a good person, seems to transcend economic class, age, everything else. I just think it's a universal trait almost baked into our nature.
Is any of this, you know, movement down the road to character dependent on some kind of religious belief system, or does this work equally well for people whose morals are informed by the secular society?
I think it works equally well. I just observe as a matter of, you know, life experience. I know a lot of secular people, atheists, who are completely wonderful people. And I know a lot of religious people who are completely wonderful people. And I know a lot in each camp who are not so wonderful. And so I think, you know, whether I'm a secular writer, I don't write I write about faith in the book, but I don't tell you whether you should have faith or not. I don't talk about my own faith. I'm talking about things we can all do, whether we're religious or not. One of the things I do think that's useful, though, is a lot of the words that we associate with religion, but they can be used in secular contexts or religious contexts. A beautiful word is grace. And so for religious people and for Christians, grace is the unmerited love of God, that God is showering you with love you don't deserve. But if you're a secular person, I'm sure you've had this experience where you were down, something bad happened, and your friends supported you, and unexpected people came up and showed up and supported you in a way that you did not deserve. And so whether we're talking in secular terms or in religious terms, grace should have some meaning to our life. And grace is the meaning that we're getting benefits and we're getting love and we're getting support that we don't merit. It just shows up and it's beyond anything we deserve.
How do you feel about the self-esteem movement that is sort of grounded on the idea that everybody deserves self-esteem, whether they have done anything to deserve self-esteem or not?
Yeah, I don't think much of it. It's been studied a great deal, and it doesn't produce any social benefits in the first place. There was a thought that if you told students how great they are, then they would have more confidence and they'd do better in school. But there's been a ton of research on this, and it does not work. It just doesn't work. I would contrast self-esteem to self-respect. And self-respect is earned by not being better than other people, but by being better than you used to be. And by, you know, doing when a time you face some tough decision, you do the right thing. You're constant in times of temptation. And self-respect is knowing that, you know, if something bad happens, I can get through that. I've done that before. If a great love comes along, I can enjoy that deep love and that deep pleasure. And so self-respect comes from being better than you used to be.
David Brooks is my guest. He's a columnist for The New York Times and a commentator for PBS and NPR. His new book is called The Road to Character. He'll be in town next Monday, May 11th, for events sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you want to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times columnist David Brooks. You also hear him on NPR and see him on PBS. He's got a new book out called The Road to Character, and he will be in town Monday, May 11th for events sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. David, the people that you wrote about in this book all wrote or spoke publicly or in their journals that were later revealed to the public about their journey. Why was it important for you to have a sense from the inside of the way that they transformed themselves?
Well, the book is really about inner life. A lot of what we talk about in normal life is about the outer life and, you know, how to have a good job and, you know, how to do all things, you know, eat well and all the things we enjoy. But they were sort of adventurous, adventurers of the inner life, and they were acutely aware of when they were doing well and when they weren't. Samuel Johnson, he went through the suffering that I mentioned before, and he decided to write his way toward steadiness. He had OCD, he had Tourette syndrome, he had nightmares. He was a person who just couldn't control his own brain. He couldn't control his own body. But he thought he could. If he took a look at the things that terrified him, and if he wrote about them, then he could discover whether they were really scary or not, and then at least he could understand them, and he would become more stable. And so he wrote a bunch of essays under the name Rambler, and it was about all the things that bothered him, his tendency to envy, his tendency toward laziness, his sorrow, his moments of sorrow, and his sloth. And he wrote essays about it all, and slowly he understood himself better. And sure enough, he became more stable. And he became a very solid, stable man, not only a great writer and a great achiever, but at home he kept people had nowhere else to go. He always had about 10 people at the home with him, former prostitutes, former slave, a doctor who had no money, other indigent people who had nowhere else to go. And that was part of his compassion, his empathy that developed late in life. So he did it by having a very stable philosophy of life and a very self-scrutinizing nature. And so that's sort of the course. The first step is inward. What's going on in there? What is my weakness? What do I do about it? And then the second step is outward. Who can I serve? And by serving them, I'm actually solidifying myself inside.
Maybe that's what's so different than the way we tend to do this now. If we look inward to understand ourselves, we're usually looking for the cause of our pain, you know, and what externally has caused us not to be entirely, you know, happy or self-realized, rather than looking at ways that we can turn back around and challenge ourselves to be better people and be more useful in the world.
Yeah, I'd say that's the big, I'm sort of advocating a counterculture here. In our current culture, what I call the culture of the big me, the self-esteem culture, we think our goodness is inside and the problems, the pains we feel come from outside. The people I read about in the book did not believe that. They believed a lot of their problems were inside and the solutions were outside. And so that's why they minimized the self. That's why they tried to self-quiet. And that's why they reached so fervently for institutions to serve outside. George Marshall, who's in the book, he took the U.S. military and he said, I'm just going to serve this institution. I'm never going to advocate for myself. I'm not going to become a self-promoter. I'm just going to do what's best for the Army. And by serving this institution, for him, the Army, for other people, a company or a university or whatever, he ended up creating great character in himself.
There have been critics who have read this book and basically said, who are you to say this? And I will say, having read it myself, it doesn't come across as preachy, but in fact, there is a great deal of humility here. But it struck me that in this culture where people are so accustomed to hearing everybody self-promote, whereas maybe a century ago, if you had said, I want to examine myself and here's how I did it and here are the things I thought about, people would say, well, I really admire that. Today, people think that there must be something terrible underneath you admitting that you have flaws, and they jump on the bandwagon and say, yes, you're a terrible person, we agree, and don't try to tell us what to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't expose too much of my life in the book. It's not about me. It's
no,
about
no, no,
people
I know.
Who actually achieve something, but it's quite obvious that, like everyone else, I have flaws, and I talk about them, and you know, tendency towards shallowness, and other things, a desire to be universally loved, and other things that, and so you know, I do have flaws, and I don't hold myself up at the model. The book is really a journey. I would meet these remarkable people, and I'd say, well, I've achieved a lot of career success, but I haven't made myself a remarkable people like they are. And so I just wanted to go on a journey, and I wanted to know how the journey would look. And so I got these 10 people in the book who did go on the journey. They did it successfully. I just wanted to try to copy them. And I will say, to be fair, writing a book about character doesn't give you character. And frankly, reading a book about character doesn't give you character. There's no like 7 magic steps you can take. But I think if you, first of all, these people, they give you a roadmap. Second, they take you out of the realm of thinking about career and all the things we normally think about. And at least they put you in the neighborhood of thinking about what it's like inside. And they get under your skin, and these people have become my friends. They're in my head. They're holding up a standard to follow. They're like you can have little silent conversations. And whether you pick the 10 people I have chosen or you have your own, I do think it's a good idea to have the pictures of dead people on your wall, people you really admire, and have them be having imaginary conversations with them, try to live up to their standards. And then, of course, I also think it's important to live with the living and have friends who you can go and have a conversation with and say, you know, what was a moment of suffering? What was a moment of failure? Did you turn that into a moment of a moral occasion? How were you shaped by love? How did you find your purpose in life? And how does one find a purpose in life? To gather with friends over drinks and talk about that stuff is another, you know, a much more enjoyable way to do this.
Yeah, it seems like there is value to that sharing. Did you read Little Women as a boy? Are you?
I did, but it's been a long time. My memory is not that good of it.
Early in the book, the March sisters are each given a copy of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which, you know, when I read it at like age 9 or 10, I thought that is like the worst Christmas present ever. but basically, it's this allegory, and it's a Christian work, but the idea was that they would each take it and sort of use it to help understand their own flaws and work through them. And it wasn't something that they were given as tools for shame, or at least that's not how I remember reading it. These were things that they had to admit, you know, they all had things they could work on, and they sort of pulled each other along the way. And it's just a sort of a small subtext in the book, but it has always stuck with me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think whether you were religious or not, I think that kind of exercise was sort of in the air. And you might have been an 8 or 9 year old kid, and you think, you know, that's part of the major occupations of life. And I think we've sort of accidentally dropped that by the side of the road somewhere. And I think it's worth trying to pick up that exercise and communicating to our kids. You know, we don't want to punish them and say they're miserable sinners, but I think it's important to say, you know, you're wonderful in many ways, but everyone has little bugs in their system and you got to be aware of them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Bob in Allen. Hello, Bob.
Hello there. Oh, it's so nice to talk to you guys. Your mention of command performance reminds me of my late father and I used to listen to Ed Walker's Sunday night show at WAMU, and he was a World War II vet, and I would ask him about his experiences, and he would just clam up. There'd be no talk about that. But at his funeral, what really amazed me was he wasn't a famous man or anything, but the number of people who came to me to talk about his kindnesses, his strength. I mean, he really proved to everyone at his funeral that he was part of the greatest generation. And I think maybe that is why we call them the greatest generation, because they were humble, they gave, and they gave so much to all of us.
Yeah. Well, I would say there are a lot of young people who are like that, too. Fortunately, we're not going to their funerals, hopefully, for many decades. But you know, it is those people who inspired this book, really. And I do think I would not want to go back to the 1940s. But the one thing they had, there was a little more reticence in public culture. So, for example, if you had a typewriter back then, there were no exclamation points on the keyboards. you couldn't text in those days, because now all we do is use exclamation points. People weren't putting their colleges on the back of their car windows, sort of bragging about what college they went to or what fancy vacation place they went to. There was just more of a sense that you don't get too big for your britches. And I do think that natural reticence has a beauty and an elegance to it. That I sort of miss.
What would you suggest to people looking for role models within their own lives? You talk about the people you've met that sort of glow with a kind of, contentment and empathy for the people around them and actions that they have taken to try to do good.
Well, you know, I think we all know these people. Have a friend named Father Ray East, who's a Catholic priest in at the Anacostia neighborhood of Washington. And I just ran to him at a luncheon in a hotel in Washington maybe 10, 15 years ago. And he just like was a jolt of goodness and joy. He was just so happy. And I would only see him once a year for a few years. And the after effect of Father Ray would like stay with me for 6 months. And then I realized I need another injection of Father Ray.
What a nice thing to say about someone.
Yeah, he's so happy, and he serves in a very poor area, a very gang-ridden area, but he's just always grateful, and that quality of gratitude. For a lot of the characters in the book, their life has some great moments, some hard moments, but it almost always ends with the tranquility that's born out of gratitude. Whether they're serving as Father Ray does in a very poor area, he's just grateful for what life offers him every single day. And that gratitude just spills out into a joyousness that you just want to be around.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak now with Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi. My sense of this whole issue is, the issue that the guest raised is, in order to be good, you have to have a sense of the common good. And if you feel as though that sense of the common good has actually been lost, or that it has been degraded. You kind of answered some of this a little just a minute ago, but I'm kind of wondering now: does society really is it really seeking that sense? Do people really seek the sense of what the common good is? Or are they just kind of don't really care about the common good?
What do you think, David?
Yeah, I've never met anybody who didn't care. You know, some people have failings. Some people have bigger failings than others. But I've never met anybody who said, you know, I don't really care if I contribute to society or not. Even like people have done interviews with killers. I used to be a police reporter. And even people have done interviews with serial killers and mass murderers. They invent some story for why what they've done was good. People can't live with themselves thinking I'm bad or I don't care about the common good. I think people care. I think they just don't always know how to behave it. Or the whole problem of character seems like so vague. And it's so like, how do you tackle this thing? There's a sociologist named Christian Smith who asked college students, name your last moral dilemma. And 70% of them could not name a moral dilemma. They didn't have the vocabulary. They'd say, you know, I pulled into a parking space, but I didn't have any quarters. And he would say, you know, that's a problem. It's not really a moral dilemma. and they just didn't have the words. And so one of the tasks for all of us, and one of the things I try to do in the book, is just say, here's what it looks like. Here's what that internal journey looks like. Here's some of the words you can apply to it. Here's how other people have done it. Just to sort of pin it down so there's handholds, so there's ladder steps, rather than just a vague morass.
Have you ever had the experience of seeing a candid photograph of yourself and thinking, I didn't know the back of me looked that way, or I didn't know I had these wrinkles in my face or whatever? And it's because all of us look in the mirror in the morning and without realizing it, we sort of pose for ourselves, right? We stand in the most flattering ways. It seems like maybe we're susceptible to that when we go to examine our own character as well. How do you get in the habit of looking honestly at yourself, not because you want to loathe yourself, but because you want to, you know, fix what you can?
Yeah, no, I have those candid pictures. My NPR ID card is embarrassingly ugly. And we do. We, you know, if you ask people, 92% of college professors believe they have above average teaching skills. I think 90% of high school kids say they're above average leaders. We all think we're better than we are. We grade ourselves on this forgiving curve. And I'm a teacher now, and I grade my kids on a very forgiving curve. I think the average GPA has gone up like 30% in the last 20 years. And so it takes – humility is just stepping outside that tendency to think, I'm really wonderful. I'm way better than most people. And it can be done with great gentleness and care. But it has to be done, I think, by following models of people who've done it. Dorothy Day in the book keeps a journal, and she sits and writes about herself in a way that's loving. She's a gracious person she has a duty to delight. So she's not beating herself up and torturing herself, but she's just saying, I could have done better this. Or often I'm a pro at sins of omission, where there was a moment where I could have really done something nice for somebody, and somehow I just didn't know what to do at the time, or I didn't pause. Those are things where you can just try to be mindful of the moment and say, you know, that was a sin of omission. I have a quote in the book of a great phrase I liked, an unattempted loveliness. Which is a sin of omission. And I think a lot of us are guilty of that one.
David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times and commentator for NPR and the PBS NewsHour. His new book is The Road to Character. He'll be in town next Monday, May 11th, for events sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm at Chris Boyd Think on Twitter. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.